Welcome to Inventure's Life Science Innovation Podcast. This is the podcast that showcases the awesome life science innovation happening around Texas. I'm your host, Jeffrey, accompanied with my co-host, too.
Hi.
Today, we have the pleasure of talking with the co-founders of Novothelium. Novothelium is an early-stage biotech company that focuses on nipple reconstruction. Let's welcome Drs. Lauren Cornell and Bianca Sequeira.
Hi, Lauren, and hi, Bianca.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Hi, nice to speak with you.
Thank you for joining us today. First, I would like to ask you to briefly tell us about yourself and a little more about Novothelium.
So, hi, I'm Lauren Cornell, and I'm Bianca Sequeira. I'm a scientist. I met Bianca in grad school and also an entrepreneur.
Yeah, so we met back in 2010. We were both in the biomedical engineering graduate program, the joint program between UTSA and UT Health San Antonio. So that's how we first met, and then we became, you know, good friends over time. And then Lauren and I, we both have a family history of breast cancer in our family. So, you know, we were just talking about things, and Lauren brought up the idea of an acellular nipple areolar graft for nipple reconstruction. And I was like, oh my God, that's the greatest idea ever. Like, why hasn't anyone done this yet? Like, you know, what's out there in the literature? So we looked around and we couldn't really find anything related to that. So then that's when we decided, okay, yeah, let's go forward and start working on this. And thus Novothelium was born. And that's exactly what we do. We're working to provide an acellular nipple areolar graft. And the idea is that it can be transplanted onto a patient after they've lost a nipple due to mastectomy or trauma. Sorry, that was a very long-winded answer, guys.
That's okay. That's actually very nice. I actually have a question about what is currently being done after a patient had gone through a mastectomy.
Yes. So right now there are two options that patients have when they're undergoing a mastectomy. So one is a nipple sparing mastectomy. So that's where the breast tissue is removed, but the nipple is left on. And then the other option is just a regular skin sparing mastectomy where the skin on the breast is left on, but the nipple is removed. So nipple sparing mastectomies didn't really come into play until about 10 years ago because they weren't sure what the long-term safety profile would be. Mm-hmm. For the patient, the best option for them obviously is to, you know, retain as much nipple tissue as they can. But depending on where the cancer is located, that may not be an option for patients if the cancer is too close to the nipple. So currently the standard of care for nipple reconstruction is a surgical skin flap. So that's where the skin on the reconstructed breast is cut and sutured together, kind of like origami, to recreate the appearance of the nipple. And this is the last stage of breast reconstruction. And then it's usually followed up with a tattoo for desired pigmentation. And some patients decide to only have the tattoo. It's a less invasive option for patients. And especially at this point, like, they've already gone through so many surgeries and, you know, radiation or chemotherapy or, you know, whatever their treatment plan was. So some patients are just fatigued and, you know, want a least invasive option. So a nipple tattoo would be a good option for that. And then another option, which is a completely non-invasive option, is a prosthesis. This is like a silicone nipple that you can put on and you can apply it daily. It requires adhesive, you know, to take it on and off as you wish.
Yeah, so there's a lot of temporary options. Mm-hmm. It's really the short of it. So you can either have a tattoo, a temporary nipple tattoo, the silicone prosthesis, or do the surgery to make a skin flap and make it look like you have a nipple. But no option today currently provides an actual nipple of any kind.
Yeah. And a current complication with the surgical skin flap is that because you just have scar tissue together, it flattens out over time. So it doesn't really provide a long-term nipple replacement option for patients. And it's really crazy to think that this technique was first introduced in the late 1940s, and it is still the standard of care today.
We're working to update that. Oh, there is one other technique which is not often used, but you can take half of your, if you have one nipple retained, you can take a part of that healthy nipple and transplant it to your other breast. But there's obvious drawbacks to that, you know, where mm-hmm. now you have a partially cut up nipple on one side. So mm-hmm. that is an option, but it's not done very frequently. Yeah. To our
knowledge. And then in the 70s, nipple banking, where they would take the nipple off and then put it somewhere else on the body. And then after the end, you're done with your, you know, your reconstruction, then they would put it back on. That was something they did then. They don't really do that very often now. It's kind of fallen out of favor.
Huh. That's interesting. It seems like what being used in the clinic is just either for temporary, or there are no good solution to, you know, nipple regeneration after a mastectomy.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, I feel like a lot of things with nipple reconstruction, it's such a personal thing, and just with breast reconstruction in general, right? I mean, mm-hmm. at this point, patients, you know, they've gone through the traumatic experience of treating their cancer, you know, they're happy to be alive, you know, and more than anything, they just want to feel like their normal self again, you know?
Yeah.
So that's something that we're hoping to provide to them, especially because there are lots of studies that show specifically nipple reconstruction plays an important role in the emotional recovery after reconstruction.
Yeah, we just want to give women a choice, more choices.
Yeah. Because again, some women, they want, like, you know, I'm done with surgery, or, you know, they have to care for, you know, they have a sick spouse and they have young children. They don't have the financial means to, like, take time off. So more than anything, we just want to have women have more options so they can choose what's best for them. And then also be aware of what options are out there. Because that's one thing that we interestingly have experienced. So we've gone through the National Science Foundation iCor program. So as part of that, we've interviewed, I mean, at this point, probably more than 200 patients who've gone through breast reconstruction. And there's a large proportion of patients who they feel like they're not completely aware of what all the options are when they're going through treatment. And then, like, after the fact, they were like, oh, well, I didn't know that this is how it was going to turn out, or I didn't know that that was an option for me. So I think an important part of our mission is just patient advocacy and patient education so that they can help, they can decide, you know, what's best with them with the help of their clinicians.
So is this like a transplant therapy? What direction is this actually going?
Well, in some ways. So basically we work with cadaveric tissue. So, you know, like tendons and things like that, people donate their organs. We get donated nipple areolar tissue. And so what we do is we take that tissue and we decellularize it. So we remove the DNA and the cells that are in the tissue from the previous owner. And then it sort of becomes, well, it does become an acellular tissue scaffold. And that scaffold is placed onto the patient, and then your cells grow into it over time and it incorporates into your skin. So it's an acellular skin transplant, if you will, but there's no living components like you would with an organ transplant. So you don't need immunosuppressants, if that makes sense.
Okay, so compatibility would not be an issue in this case.
Correct.
Oh, that makes it a lot easier then.
Yes. I was saying there's similar products on the market, but not used for nipples, that use acellular human dermis. You know, Alloderm is a famous one. So it's very well scientifically accepted. We're just really innovating in a new space and, you know, moving forward for a mission that we think is really important.
Yeah. So, I mean, even within breast reconstruction, so a lot of times if patients have an implant-based reconstruction, there may not be enough soft tissue to support the weight of the implant, especially if they've had, you know, radiation, that kind of thing that can negatively impact skin quality. So in some of these patients, surgeons will use a product like acellular dermis to kind of create a sling to hold the implant in. And that's used in the majority of implant-based reconstructions right now. So it's a good thing because physicians are already aware of, like, what the process is for this type of tissue. It's already used in breast reconstruction. There are already existing insurance reimbursement codes for these types of acellular tissue products, and then procedural codes for use of these products in breast reconstruction. So it kind of makes it an easier pathway for us to get into this market.
Mm-hmm. So how long does it take for the whole procedure and the healing process, you know, for your product and for the acellular procedure that's currently being used?
Well, we haven't made it to clinical trials yet, so we really can't give, you know, a solid answer. But, you know, we would estimate it's probably going to take your typical wound healing time, maybe 8 to 12 weeks. But again, we don't really have a firm timeline on that.
Okay.
So your idea, all you started with was doing a literature search to see what was out there?
Yeah, so we started with nothing. We had zero lab space. We were both graduate students at the time working on other projects.
I was not a graduate student.
Oh, wait, you had finished. Yeah, she had finished her master's degree. So I was a PhD student at the time. She was doing research elsewhere. So yeah, we had, like, nothing
nothing to begin with.
And
right?
We were so young. Like, think back on it. And the thing is too, you know, had the idea years and years before, didn't know what to do. And then finally, over tea one day, talking with Bianca, she was just like, let's just start. Like, yeah, you know, like,
do it.
Because I think a lot of people get hung up on, and I experienced it myself, I don't know where to begin. And I have this idea, but it seems so huge and insurmountable. And, you know, any step you take is really a right step because it's making progress. So with nothing, we started. And
so the first thing we did is that we contacted the entrepreneur, the site program at UTSA, Center for Innovation, Technology, Entrepreneurship, I think is what it stands for. Anyways, so we were like, hey, we have this idea. Like, do you have any pointers, you know, like courses we can do online or something like that? So then they referred us to one of the local NSF iCorp programs that they were doing. It was at MD Anderson. That was the first one that we did. So we submitted an application for that, and that really helped us, you know, get our feet on the ground to start moving with it, and especially like talking directly to people who are involved in the space. Because I mean, it requires zero money to do that, and you learn so much by talking to people about it.
One of the other first things we did was get a patent lawyer.
Oh yeah.
You know, because we wanted to protect the idea, so we actually interviewed several people. Just wanted to see who spoke science. And we were able to find an attorney pretty quickly and start the process of filing a provisional patent. And so that offered us some protection as we moved forward and, you know, started trying to learn about creating our business.
That's actually very smart to start with.
Yes, I would say if there's anything that you should not scrimp on money,
it is
a good patent attorney.
Patent attorney
is one of those things.
We will tell you. So here's the thing. We start, again, we're both kind of broke at this stage of our life. And, you know, we found this patent attorney and, you know, to file a provisional patent, it, you know, was $3,000 to $5,000, mm-hmm. I think. And we both put up the money for that because we were like, this is important enough to us that we want to, you know, invest this money and just see where this goes. And, that's a very worthy investment. If you're really passionate about it and you think you want to dedicate the next several years of your life to it, we would highly recommend it. So. Mm-hmm. And in the long run, that's not that much money.
Yeah. Yeah. And as a graduate student, how did you even know that you can start your own company? How did you come up with, come across this idea?
You know, we were fortunate. A lot of our, so we were in the biomedical engineering program, and there were other students, and there was that program, translational science. Mm-hmm. It wasn't translational science. There was a business program that came through the biomedical engineering department, and you could take a couple classes and get a certificate. So did you do that program?
I did not do that program.
But... Well, several people in our school did. And so this idea started coming up that like, oh, you can take business classes. But I think just more than that, Bianca and I were always very business minded. I mean, throughout grad school, like she had a quilting business. I had a banana bread business. We were always trying to hustle something. So we'd always wanted a business. And so then when you know, there was these classes going through, neither one of us took them. But I think the idea just sort of sparked like, hey, we can do this. And why not? And yeah. At the time, you know, it's mostly like your professors who like after years and years, they start a business, right? But, you know, we're millennials. We just like, why not? Go for it. So,
and I guess at least for me, there was one seminar that I went to, and it was part of the translational science fellowship that I had. We had these weekly seminars and they had different speakers, right? And, you know, usually in graduate school, it's, you know, very science, you know, research oriented speakers, but there was one that spoke about entrepreneurship and, you know, startups and all that kind of thing. And like prior to that, it had never crossed my mind that that was an option. So that I think kind of like helped, you know, there were lots of little seeds that were planted. And then, you know, we were like, well, you know, if other people can do it, why can't we do it? We should do it.
Yeah. And don't sell your quilting business short. It was very good. Sorry. She makes lovely quilts.
Thank you.
But yeah, so we're just, I think, ingrained in us a little bit. And both of our parents, because your dad has an entrepreneurial spirit and my parents do too. So lots of, you know, little seeds, as you said.
So I know that you've all participated in a bunch of pitch competitions and won a bunch of awards. I think it was like more than 20. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences with the pitch competitions and like what you learned and possible advice to give somebody that's working on their pitch day?
Yes. So we, as again, we mentioned, we started with nothing, right? So we had no funds to support any of this besides the initial funding we put towards a patent attorney and you know, incorporating our company. So we were like, hey, like what options are out there? So we reached out to the, it was Bijou Matthews, at the
our first
Institute
one was
for
the
Economic
Governors.
Yeah, but yeah. He's the one that referred us to it. So the Institute for Economic Development. So we had looked at applying for SBIR funding. And as part of learning more about that, we got connected to the Institute for Economic Development. Bijou Matthews there has been really helpful for us over these past 5 years now. Anyway, so he sent us an email. It's like, hey, here's a pitch competition. You should apply. And it was for women founded companies in Texas. And this was the first one of these pitch competitions that they had for women. And I remember at the time I was like 9 months pregnant and we were like, okay, well, you know, why not? It's an application. And a lot of times, you know, it's just an online application. You submit it and then you find out if you're accepted or not. So we weren't even sure this was the first one we'd ever apply to if we would get accepted. So we were accepted. And so 11 days after my daughter was born, we went to this pitch competition. It was our first one. We were so nervous. We didn't really know what to expect. And these are, you know, it's not just biotech, but these are, you know, from women from all over Texas. There were like food companies. There were, you know, cosmetic
beauty,
companies,
catering.
So like anything you can think of. They were there. So we pitched and we ended up winning first place.
We couldn't believe it.
We
they called
shocked.
Our names, just completely shocked. Yeah.
Completely shocked. So then we were like, wow, like, you know, like
you can make money doing this. Like,
so
that's crazy.
The first prize was $5,000. We're like, oh my God, this is amazing. We have $5,000. You know, we can use this to buy lab supplies.
We have money.
Yeah. We're not completely broke.
We got a bank account.
So then we're like, hey, like, you know, maybe we should apply more of these. So then we just started, you know, searching online. And there are a lot of opportunities for students. There are a lot of opportunities in the biotech space. So just over time, we would keep looking, and then just keep applying. And, you know, the more applications you submit, the better you get, just like with anything.
I like to call it, like, I don't know if you guys have watched Bridgerton, you can cut this part out, but it was like our season of pitches. Like, we just sort of entered in and we did everything we possibly could. And we got so much out of that because it's free advice.
Yes.
And as scientists and engineers and we can take criticism well and we can recreate it to help us, right? That's really our job if you think about it. And we got all this free advice at each competition. We're like, great, thank you. And we like would make it better. And then we go on to the next one.
And revamp our pitch every time, you know, address questions that other people have. Like, so every time our pitch is getting more and more and more refined. And then, you know, we make new connections, get new mentors. So, I mean, there's so much that we got out of those pitch competitions besides, you know, the financial ability to, you know, fund our research. But yeah, I would highly recommend it to anyone out there because, again, you know, you have nothing to lose. Like, you know, you submit an application, it takes, you know, 1 or 2 hours out of your day, but you learn so much from it.
Yeah. It's like presenting a poster. Yeah. In a way, you know.
Yeah, and it's good practice because I mean, once you get to the point where you're, you know, pitching to investors, you've already pitched your thing so many times that it's not a nerve-wracking thing. You know, you have it very polished. So I feel like it's a good, you know, safe environment for you to kind of test out your pitch.
So did you know how to give a good pitch before you gave your first one?
It was our very first one.
I mean, so, as scientists, we've had some training in presenting our scientific research for our various fields. So I would say, you know, we had that. But, you know, Bianca had not finished her PhD yet. I'd just done my master's. So I hadn't gone through a PhD program. So we were very green. But, you know, I think the key thing that I've learned anyway, you can give your 2 cents. But if you speak to passion with something and clarity, you have to be clear and concise, but passion really connects with people. So I think just, and we were told that often, like, you guys are so excited. I'm really connecting with you emotionally. And I think we're also fortunate that our idea and our product and company, it's easy to emotionally connect to it. Mm-hmm.
There's so many people that are impacted by breast cancer. Like after every single time we do a pitch, there's always someone who comes up to us and is like, oh, you know, my mother went through this, or I went through this, or my sister, you know, so it impacts so many people that I feel like we're fortunate that it's easy to connect to people about it.
And I think to them, it's good for them to see that someone's working on a solution.
Yes. 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 Cause I think for a lot of patients, they almost feel like it's like too much to ask for to have something better. You know, I mean, I don't know. There's so much emotion packed into this type of thing that mm-hmm. we want women to know that like, it's okay if you want something better. Like, you know, there are better options out there.
I mean, there's always going to be, you know, people who are trying to regrow limbs or, you know, there's so many important causes, but, you know, we just want people to know that this is important too. And, we're happy to spend our lives working on it. So
I know like, kind of communicating your science is a little difficult. Do you have any like problems with people not understanding what exactly you're trying to accomplish?
Yes. and we are getting help for that actually to help us kind of reframe. Because we want to be accurate and we want to say what it is, but that doesn't always translate.
And then again, it also depends on who your audience is, right? So mm-hmm. sometimes if you're speaking to a clinician, they understand more of the technical details. If you're talking to a lay audience and, you know, you want to make it more accessible. So yeah, we've tried many different versions of like, you know, a tissue engineered nipple, a nipple areolar matrix, a nipple areolar graft. So, I mean, depending on the audience, I think we kind of modify how we present it.
Yes. And we've gotten some advice from, you know, people in marketing, and we'll try out those different things here and there. So, we're still open to learning in that arena.
Yeah. And I think, it's also helpful, like if, you know, to speak to people kind of outside of your field to say like, you know, hey mom, like, does this make sense to you? You know? So again, reach out to your friends and family to make sure that what you're presenting is understandable to someone outside the field.
Mm-hmm. And at which point among all of these pitch competitions did you, get a lab space and started working more on, creating this product?
So we got a donation while I was pregnant with Ariana from the Lester Smith Foundation, remember? Because prior to that, we didn't have any lab data.
I think it was a year.
It all blends together now.
We're like, okay, sorry.
What child was I pregnant with?
let's redo it this way. It certainly wasn't right away.
Yeah.
So we had a long lead time where we didn't have lab space, and that was okay because what we were doing during that time was we filed our provisional, we were gathering money, and we were gathering support. Because when you're, I mean, it's the truth of the matter, when you're new to the field and you're a scientist, you're not a business background, sometimes you need to gain recognition for people to be like, you know what, I back this. And so we used that time to like get these awards, get this funding, get knowledge in how we could improve our product. And then we ended up getting the lab, you know, I want to say it was a year in. And by the time we got that space, we already had all this stuff lined up. We knew tweaks we wanted to do. We knew the resources to get our tissue from. And we had people saying, we want to support you on this journey. So I would say don't be super intimidated if you don't have a lab right away. You can do so much in that time to just garner funding and build out your team.
Yeah. And there were a lot of experiments, like, because we kind of pivoted on what our original plan was. Our original plan was to process the tissue to decellularize it, and then we were going to put cells back on. But then when we went through the iCor program, then we at MD Anderson, then we were like, okay, well, the regulatory pathway for putting cells back on is way more difficult than for an acellular product. And then we learned more about the acellular dermal products that are already on the market that are do not have cells put on them before they're put into the patient. So we're like, hey, well, like, if we don't even need to do that step, then, you know, that saves us a lot of time. And those, you know, those are, if we had had the money, we probably would have started experiments doing that. And then we would have like wasted that money, wasted that time. So again, talking to people is free, and you can save, you know, resources on doing experiments that you don't need to do just by, you know, talking to people who are more experienced in the field and doing, you know, going through literature review, going through the products that are already available.
So while you were filing the patent, were you wary about talking to people about your idea, and because it's not it wasn't protected yet?
So the thing about iCore is you never talk about your idea. You're just supposed to go and interview people. So you just ask them what their problem is. So like we would just interview people and be like, hey, tell me about your breast cancer reconstruction, and just listen. Mm-hmm. So we would never say what our idea was. And we were always very careful to keep that that information private. So we never would disclose it until, you know, there is a certain amount of research that you have to do before you decide to put the money up front to do these kind of things, right? Mm-hmm. But yes, we were always in that program. They encourage you to just listen rather than sell your idea. So we didn't do that. We just kind of like, okay, well, tell me about it.
Huh. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. It's just so that founders would feel more safe, I guess, in sharing and learning more about what they're getting themselves into.
Mm-hmm. How hard was it to find lab space?
It's difficult. It's getting better in San Antonio. You know, there are a couple options, like UTSA had some lab space. I believe the Health Science Center does. Now there's some incubators popping up around the city. You know, where we, you know, use lab space at the Crown Sci Center, at the San Antonio Technology Center, there's a couple labs in there. So it's certainly gotten much easier with time. But, you know, 5-6 years ago, it was much more difficult. But I would say if you're looking to rent space now, it's much more feasible. And there's several both private, nonprofit, and, you know, university options you can look through.
And then one thing that's important to consider is what type of equipment is included. And again, this is dependent on, you know, what type of studies you're doing. But there are some spaces where they only have like the physical room, but no equipment. So, you know, that's just something to consider.
And if I'm not mistaken, you both have full-time careers. How do you manage your time? What are the commitments and sacrifices you have to make this work?
Well, we don't really have a social life outside of this. I mean, although now with COVID, you know, everyone's kind of in the same boat with that. But yeah, I mean, there are times when I look back and I'm like, how did we do all of that? Like you just do it, right? Like you just do it, especially if it's something that you have a passion for. Like it's easy to, you know, keep the momentum going and just like focus on like, okay, this is really important. Like we're going to get it done.
It takes a toll though.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, so Bianca, she had, you know, a job and babies. And then at one point I was in my PhD program full-time, doing my full-time job and doing Novothelium. So, you know, there are moments when you, or years really, when you, you just power through. But I think at the end of the day, that's why you have to be so connected to that goal and that mission and really feel passionate about it. And, you know, I've heard this before, that a lot of people say that they really want to have a business, but they just want a business. And I'm like, that's great. That's wonderful passion. But I would just recommend that whatever it is you're going to do, make sure that you love it, because there are so many highs and lows in entrepreneurship. I mean, the highs are fantastic, but people only see the highs, right? Mm-hmm. Behind the scenes, there's all kinds of, I mean, we've all seen those, you know, little,
the ice
graphics. Yeah. Yes. We've all seen it. It's true. It's true for a reason. So it's been tough, but, we've persevered and we're starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel. And I would say it's totally been worth it.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like having a child. I feel like this is like our third baby together, you know, our company. And
we're basically married in this company. So, I mean,
and we're like, look how big it is now. Now it has an issued patent.
Yeah. You know?
But I mean, you know, you like, you help it grow and, you know, you want it to succeed. You know, it's just, again, it's a lot of work, but I feel really proud about, you know, what we've accomplished through this time.
Yeah, it seems like you started this company in, what was, when?
2015.
October. So in less than 6 years, mm-hmm. You've accomplished a lot in less than 6 years.
Yeah, I mean, for starting with nothing and, you know, still having our full-time jobs and school and all that, though we're definitely ready to move at a quicker pace. So we feel like we've made a lot of progress. showing that our product works and that it has a lot of potential. And so, you know, the next few years we hope will bring us closer to the market and closer to hopefully changing people's lives and giving them this great new product. Mm-hmm. And just really excited thinking about, I just can't wait for it to happen. So getting closer.
So is it more difficult to have started your company without having like the preclinical research that would have been done at an academic institution?
Yes and no, because, you know, on one hand, you have that research that kind of supports you moving forward. But I think and this is just my personal opinion, Bianca may a different opinion. I think from a business perspective, you have less options in how to proceed because, you know, you don't own that research really. It's owned by the university, mm-hmm. and you don't have as much say in who you're going to collaborate with or who's going to buy it perhaps. So, you know, yes, you could have years of data that helps you launch it, but from the business perspective, you don't have as much freedom to, you know, move forward.
Yeah, I agree that I think you're less agile.
Agile is a good word, yeah.
In the business part of it. Correct. So, I mean, I think it was difficult for us at the beginning because people were like, oh, okay, well, how do you know this will work? Well, what data do you have? This will never work. Like, we had so many people that were like,
this haters. Is like,
yeah.
And we're a lot
like,
of haters.
No, but look, right? And now that we're like, see, it worked. But I think that we're able to make, you know, quick decisions. Like, we have control about who we partner with, like who, you know, who will license it to or sell it, you know. So I think that, because that was one thing that we did consider about was whether to have the IP through the university or have it, you know, through us.
Mm-hmm. And not that we needed to go through the university, we just didn't know if that would be an easier path. Because since we were students, you could do that option, mm-hmm. but we chose not to. And since none of the research was existed at all, there had been no previous work done, there was nothing that we had to go through university, if that mm-hmm. makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Before we end the conversation, I was just wondering if you had any advice for PhD students or other young professionals that are thinking about starting their own companies.
I would say just do it. Like little steps, right? It can seem like a really daunting thing at the beginning because you're like, oh no, like where do I begin? I don't, you know. But just baby steps. Like the first thing we did was, you know, like make an appointment to talk to someone, you know, and you just do little things over time and then it builds up. And then also I think it's really important to have something that you're really, really passionate about because, you know, there are lots of long days. So you want it to be something that where you have a passion that will drive you forward through anything.
And I would say, have a good support system.
Yes.
Because, you know, when you're doing it by yourself, it can be lonely. Mm-hmm. And if you have co-founders or mm-hmm. people in your life or friends that support you, then it makes all the difference. So I would say,
That's probably the most important thing.
And if you don't have a co-founder, if you don't have a friend that's business-minded, you can join groups of other people who are business owners who kind of know what you're going through. Mm-hmm. So find a support group, find a friend, find a co-founder, you know, whatever you need to do, but don't do it alone.
Yeah, definitely. I would say that I don't think that there was anyone else that I could do this with besides you.
Aww. I love you.
Oh, I love you.
Yeah. And can I make a shameless plug? I don't know if it would go at the end, but so we, in an effort to support our continued research, we have recently come out with a line of temporary nipple areola tattoos, like the press-on ones that we would do as kids. They are all hand-drawn and designed by Bianca, and they're beautiful, and they look really great. And so that is a new product that we've launched to help support our research moving forward. So if you know anyone that's interested, we've got
them out.
Yeah.
How do we find more information about that?
Novothelium.com/tattoos. And they come in different colors. So if you want a blue nipple, we have that. If you want a pink one, we have that too.
And you can apply them, you know, if you don't have a existing nipple, of course you can use it for that. But they actually also can be applied over existing nipple tissue just to change the color. So we've tested that out. And Bianca's looking very proud right now. So.
And again, like more than anything, we just want more options for people, right? So this mm-hmm. is another option. We checked out some of the existing temporary nipple tattoos and we were like, yeah, there's room for improvement. So
check him out. We're proud.
That's really nice. It's just, I guess this can also be seen as another type of body art, like a regular tattoo.
Ooh, I like that.
Yes. Yes. There are lots of people who, like after the reconstruction, right? Because you have scarring, they'll get these like elaborate like flower tattoos or these really elaborate cool designs over their breasts. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of really beautiful expression that could be done with these types of things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think that was the last question. Thank you so much, Lauren and Bianca, for your time and for sharing your stories.
Oh yeah. Thank you for interviewing us.
Thank you. It was really nice to speak with you again.
Thank you.
That was Bianca and Lauren from Novothelium. Just like they mentioned, any progress, regardless of how small, is still progress towards your goal. If you have an idea, don't be afraid to take that first step. Remember, the steps you take don't have to be big. They just need to take you in the right direction.